personal finance and fitness? Find out what these two have in common on this episode of Unlock Your Wealth Today, Your Life Fully Invested. Welcome to Unlock Your Wealth Today, Your Life Fully Invested. I'm your purveyor of prosperity and host, Heather Wagenhals, and I am making success simple on today's episode by blending personal finance and fitness. Yes, you think, what do they have to do with each other? Actually, a lot, because health is wealth, and wealth is more than money. So I just threw a couple of little sayings at you, like, okay, what does that mean? Because this is a biology-based approach to money management and success, we take a physiology-first approach. And how can we make effective decisions if our brains aren't right? If we're not giving our brains and our bodies the tools they need, like nutrition and proper exercise, how on earth are we going to be able to make effective decisions when it comes to our money management? Never fear, I have encountered a new fitness trainer that is the deal. I've had several hurdles this past year with regards to my health and well-being. And in my journey out of the muck, I have encountered this gentleman who's going to be our guest, and I'm super excited about him because he's an incredible philosopher in addition to being an exercise physiology guy. And he's got some really neat ideas about training and fitness. And I'm looking forward to him sharing them on today's episode. So let's get started. Drew, welcome to Unlock Your Wealth Today. I'm thrilled to have you a part of the show.
Well, thanks, Heather. I'm glad to be here. Looking forward to it.
You know, one of the biggest mantras that I've always had, probably for, I don't know, since I was moving, I suppose, is that, you know, your health is your wealth. And without good health, you can't think clearly. You're not providing your body and your brain with the right supply of nutrition and oxygen. And you can't be effective at what you do every day. And so I'm really excited to have somebody that has such an incredible philosophy for training on the show. So when you first found bodybuilding, what were you doing before? Tell us about your journey through exercise.
Oh, man. I started working out probably when I was about 11 years old. Started taking martial arts, doing Taekwondo classes then. And they had us doing bodyweight exercises, push-ups, squats, things like that. And I went to classes 3 days a week, but I was obsessive about practicing. So I would do the best I could at home to go through the exact things they had us doing in class, including those bodyweight exercises. Eventually started training with weights. I got a cheap barbell set from the father of one of my sister's friends, worked out with that in our basement, and worked out with some friends of ours. None of us had any idea what we were doing. Then we started reading muscle magazines for advice and started doing things even less sensibly as a result. Those things are not good sources of information. Real quick tangent. The muscle magazines began as barbell catalogs with tips in them. And eventually, the people selling them realized that once you sell somebody a barbell set, you've removed them from the market. And they started selling supplements and adding more and more tips and articles to these supplement catalogs. And these supplement catalogs eventually grew into the current bodybuilding magazines. They're all owned by companies selling supplements. And everything is geared towards getting you to buy those rather than informing you about exercise. They're just making stuff up on a monthly basis. A lot of the articles by the bodybuilders and fitness personalities in there are ghostwritten. It's awful. It's entertainment. I mean, it can be inspiring if you keep in mind that the people there are all pharmaceutically enhanced and genetically above average, but they're horrible places for information. And following these, we went from doing from not knowing what we were doing, but at least being somewhat sensible, to doing a ridiculous amount of exercise on almost a daily basis. Got into high school and got similar bad information from well-meaning coaches, and got okay results, probably just because of being a teenager at the time, which you can, if you train hard at all, you're going to be at least somewhat responsive, but not nearly worthwhile results for the amount of time invested. Eventually, when I was in college, I started reading Iron Man magazine, still following the same nonsense, but I came across Mike Mentzer's articles, and they were interesting to me because Dorian Yates, who was the Mr. Olympia at the time, was a client, was training with Mike Mentzer. And Mike was the first person who I read. Now, he's not the first person to say this. You know, I wish I had encountered some of L. Darden's or Arthur Jones' writings earlier. But Mike was the first one that I read that talked about exercise not directly producing improvements in the body, but rather being the stimulus for improvements, and the importance of allowing your body adequate time between workouts to fully recover and respond. Now, at this time, I was grossly overtrained. In fact, in college, I'd actually lost muscle and strength since high school because I also started running regularly. I was in the gym probably 4 or 5 days a week for an hour and a half or more at a time. And on top of that, I was running almost daily. Mm-hmm. Weighed about 150 pounds, and I was moderately lean, but not very well built. After I started reading Mike's stuff for a while, I was skeptical at first, but he presented his points very well. I said, you know what? I'll try this. We'll see what happens. And I cut my workouts back from doing 3-4 sets of several exercises for every muscle group, splitting the whole thing up over, again, 4 or 5 days a week, sometimes more than that. I dropped the running entirely and ended up only working out for maybe about 20 minutes twice a week. And I was just alternating upper-lower body, Monday, Friday. In about 6 months, I gained over 30 pounds and was actually a little bit leaner. I remember I was 183. I actually started modeling for GNC around this time, doing the in-store mannequin modeling, and remember getting on the scale there, being 183. It was about as heavy as I've been in very lean condition. I'm about 5'8". So 5'8".
Okay.
Just about. 5'7¾", but I'll just say, we'll say 5'8". And after just transforming that rapidly, before, I would have been pretty much ignored in the gym. Nobody's coming up to me and asking me for advice on everything. And I remember, people starting to just come up to me and ask me for advice. This is the first time that I'm the guy that people are asking about this stuff. And I told them what I was doing, and most of them thought that I was lying to them. When I told them that I was working out like 20 minutes twice a week, they thought, no way. Accusations of steroids and all the other stuff followed. But a couple people that were paying attention noticed that, yeah, I was not there all the time anymore. I was barely ever at the gym, and asked if I would train them. And I figured, okay, sure. And just decided this is what I should be doing to make money while I'm in college. It was good money. It was a flexible schedule. I never intended for this to become a career. But after a while, I decided, I really enjoy this. This is what I would rather be doing. I was studying biology at the time, and I switched over to exercise physiology. It's at University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, back in the mid-90s. One thing led to another. Eventually, I moved down to Florida to work with a former Nautilus researcher, Ken Hutchins, and I've been at this stuff ever since.
That's an incredible story. I mean, to be able to follow it like that. I know the two most valuable classes I felt like I got out of high school was auto shop, because I needed to know how my car worked, and anatomy and physiology, because I needed to know how my body worked.
Well, the anatomy and physiology stuff in college, very useful. And I think anybody that's interested in exercise should take classes. Even just, you know, go to your local community college and take some classes on human biology and anatomy and physiology. You have to understand the stuff if you really want to understand exercise. What was awful, though, is the exercise physiology courses that I took felt like kindergarten classes compared to the general science classes. And I suspect that they were being watered down for the sake of giving the athletes easy classes to maintain their grades. UWGB is a big basketball school. And again, I'm barely 5'8". I felt like a midget in my exercise phys classes. Even the most of the girls were taller than me. And but it was like kindergarten stuff. And the biggest problem, though, is in exercise physiology, they talk a lot about physiology, and they talk a lot about endurance training, but they give very little practical advice on actually exercising. And when they do try, it's usually nonsense. In fact, I argued with my exercise phys professor more than anything else, to the point where he got so frustrated with me in one class, because he would be talking about something and people would raise their hands. They'd ask a question, he'd answer, I'd raise my hand, and then when he called on me, I'd argue with his answer and tell him that's wrong, et cetera, et cetera. Got so frustrated with me at one point, lost his temper and said, if you think you know so much, why don't you come up and teach the class? And he walked out. So I got up, I walked to the front of the room, and I spent the rest of the time talking to people about strength training, about this stuff. It was a waste of time. I learned more in the first few months after I moved down to Florida working with Ken Hutchins than I did in all the time that I took exercise phys classes. How I met Mike Mentzer later was, I mentioned that after I, you know, read his articles and started applying those principles and dramatically transformed myself, I started training people. Well, I was doing this at a couple places in Green Bay where I was not an employee. I would just show up and I would train people, just get a day pass, or they'd bring me in. And this did not go over well with those establishments, and they said, you can't do that. You can't just come in here and train people. You're not a trainer here. And so I went to a Gold's Gym that was close to campus and talked to the head trainer there and said, I'm training these people. I need a place to train. Would I be able to bring them here? And it just turned out that he was a phone client of Mike Mentzer's, because it worked out perfectly. One of the most frustrating things if you own a fitness business is trying to hire people, because almost all personal trainers are completely clueless. It is when you bring them in and they try to tell you all the stuff that they know, basically they're telling you how misinformed they are, and you could go through 100, 1,000 before you find one that has any idea what they're doing. And I was worried about the same thing, knowing that what I was doing is very different than was conventional, thinking I'm going to go and talk to this guy and he's going to tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. But so I go in and I tell him I'm a personal trainer, and he says, well, what do you do? And I started telling him, and I remember the look on his face is like, all right. And he says, hold on. He said, I'm a phone client of Mike Mentzer's.
Oh,
and right away he says, now, if you're going to train people here, I need you to, you know, come in, and you're going to have to shadow us first and everything. They want to make sure that I was on the same page. So through that, we actually did the conference calls with Mike and ended up just calling each other on a regular basis after moving down here. And that was more educational than anything that I got from the exercise phys classes in college.
Well, that's pretty exciting. It's really interesting to hear your journey into, you know, fitness and this evolution that now you are the fitness expert that everybody is consulting and going to. I know that's how I found you, is I was looking for a better solution with my challenges. And so after we get back from the break, let's start talking about the nuts and bolts of the type of high intensity training that you advocate. You are watching Drew Bay on Unlock Your Wealth Today. We'll be right back with more after this. Welcome back to Unlock Your Wealth Today. And let's get back to our interview with Drew Bay. I'm so excited about what this body of work means because Mike Mentzer really kind of popularized this style of training that we're going to start talking about. But in the last 20 years since his passing, you've really added to this body of work, and we just know so much more. I mean, science just evolves daily, and what we knew, you know, 5 years ago is already changing from what we knew, say, 20 years ago. So let's talk about what is HIIT fitness or this high intensity training, because you know I love your motto in I help people build better bodies without wasting hours in the gym or wrecking themselves in the process. And I have been successfully wrecked between ballroom dancing and overtraining and improper training in the gym myself. So how do you deliver on that promise? Is that what the HIIT philosophy is?
Well, first off, intensity of effort just refers to how hard you are working relative to how hard you are capable of working during an exercise. Now, a lot of people define intensity in the vague and meaningless ways, like a percentage of your one rep max that you're using or some degree of heart rate elevation. But what we're really concerned with in exercise is how hard you are working relative to your momentary ability. And the reason that's important is because exercise is a stress. You are trying to impose a stress on the body to stimulate it to produce an improvement in all of the general trainable factors of functional ability. And specifically, what we are trying to stress is your muscles' ability to produce force to move you. And to be able to stimulate the body to produce an improvement in that, we have to present it with a threat. If, for example, and this is an analogy that Mike and Arthur and a lot of others like to use, if you were to go outside in the middle of the day in August or June in Florida, you know, no clouds in the skies, very intense sunlight, that is a threat to your skin's ability to do its job protecting your insides from radiation. And if you threaten that, you're going to stimulate it to produce an adaptation to better protect against that in the future. In terms of movement, if you can't move, you cannot obtain food, you can't prevent yourself from becoming something else's food, you can't reproduce, and these are the three things that your genes are most concerned with you being able to do. Anything that threatens your ability to move is going to stimulate your body to improve that ability, starting with your muscles' ability to produce force, how strong they are, how big they are. Everything else just serves to support that. Now, if you do something that's easy, if you don't ask your muscles to do something they aren't already capable of doing, you're not giving your body a reason to improve. Muscle mass is expensive tissue to produce and maintain. It requires resources and energy to create and then more to keep. Your body is not going to do something that is expensive unless the net benefit over time is better survival. It has to be worth it. Now, if you work the muscles so hard that they are momentarily incapable of continuing the movement that you're trying to perform, you're telling your body, something in the environment is so challenging that we lack the required strength to be able to handle it. And that if we don't get more of this, the next time we encounter this, we might not survive. So that's what we mean when we're talking about intensity, is working the muscles so hard that they are momentarily incapable of further movement. If you're doing an exercise, this means continuing until you can't go any further, you can't lift the weight anymore in the prescribed form. Now, you don't want to compromise your form to do this for a variety of reasons, injury being the biggest one. But if you do that, you also take care of all of the other general trainable factors of functional ability. Cardiovascular and metabolic conditioning will improve if you're stressing the muscles. Your muscles produce movement by pulling on your bones. Your bones have to transmit the force generated by your muscles. They respond to that force by increasing their strength as well. You have increased bone density, bone mineral content. If you regularly move through a full range of motion in your exercises, your flexibility will improve. You have all of these things that follow from just increasing the muscular strength. Now, if you are training intensely, though, the greater the stress on the body, the more the cost to the body to recover from the effects of that stress. You are severely disrupting homeostasis. You are causing microscopic tears in the muscle fibers, and there is going to be a cost to repairing that. The harder you train, the greater the stress, the more important it is that you allow your body adequate time to be able to recover from that before you work out again. And this is where a lot of people screw up. Most people don't train as hard as they ought to, not even close to begin with. But if they're training even moderately hard, they're placing stress on their body that it has to be able to recover from, especially those tears in the muscle fibers, before they work out again. If they work out too soon and they haven't at least allowed a return to baseline, then they're digging a hole deeper and deeper and deeper without letting their body pile more on top, so to speak. And eventually, they end up not only not making progress, but actually even losing some of their muscle strength and size. I mentioned earlier, I actually lost muscle in college doing more, and I had a little bit more freedom with my schedule earlier on. I wasn't working as much, spent more time in the gym. And I got worse results rather than better. And you see this with a lot of people. They start working out, and sometimes what they're doing is reasonable, and they get frustrated because they don't make as much progress as they think they ought to. And so they start doing more and more and more, and instead of getting better results, they get less. More exercise is not going to stimulate any more of an adaptive response. If you're training intensely, beyond some point, the trigger has been flipped. You're not going to add to the adaptive response, but you do keep piling on the stress, the cost that your body has to pay in recovery before it's able to produce that response. Too much of it, and you're not going to leave as much for adaptation. You end up just doing, your body's doing everything it can just to recover from the stress that you're placing on it. Most people do too much exercise, and they do it way too often. They don't allow for adequate recovery and adaptation. And they're not putting in nearly as much effort as they ought to.
Well, you know, it makes me think of the economic theory of diminishing marginal utility. At some point, each successive unit doesn't deliver the same value. And that's kind of what it sounds like that you're saying.
Well, this goes beyond that. If you are training intensely enough, you very quickly hit a point of diminishing returns as your volume increases. But beyond some point, it's not just diminishing returns. You're just spinning your wheels. You're piling on the stress without increasing the your body can only produce so much of a response. Once you've stimulated as much of a response as your body can produce over some period of time, any additional work does not contribute to a greater stimulus. It just increases the cost to recover. So you quickly hit a point of diminishing returns and then no further returns. You keep doing more and more, but you're not getting any better. And beyond some point, it goes over the other side. And too much work can actually cause you to lose progress. Most people will start feeling like crap. They'll be run down before they hit that point. But a lot of people get to the point where they're making no progress and they just keep doing what they're doing without thinking about it and asking, should I change something?
Well, and because it speaks to the point that more is not necessarily better, only better is better. And I experienced this firsthand because, you know, I had three things happen last summer to me that were probably the worst things that could have ever happened. I tore cartilage in one knee, and I didn't really tear the cartilage. It came away from the bone, so there wasn't anything my doctor could do surgically. At the same time, I had arthritis set in from all the years of ballroom dancing. And then I had the lovely gift of menopause hit me. So like a Mack truck, I got mowed
all
down.
At once.
Yes. And so I backed off of everything. And I've always been, you know, a big proponent of weightlifting and going to the gym. And even though I'm long and lean and I can run fast because I have really long legs, I only like to run when things are chasing me. So I'm kind of lazy in a way. And so the first thing I sacrificed, which should have been the last thing, was weightlifting. I mean, and I should have stuck with that for my recovery. And so when I finally, you know, it took me about 9 months or so of trying to do all these other type of exercise programs that were supposed to be less injurious, and I hate using those quotes, but less injurious to the body, that didn't bring me any results, and I just kept getting fatter and fatter. And, you know, I've always had a well-manicured diet. So my diet was in line. I shouldn't have been gaining weight. It took a bit to get the hormones balanced, but all of those things were in place, and I still wasn't losing. And then a friend of mine turned me on to what you were doing, and then I kind of revisited. I'm like, yeah, I remember Mike from, like, way back in the day, and I always thought he was handsome, but I could never embrace. I was very, very skeptical about this. What do you mean train like 2 days a week? That makes no sense. You know, my first husband was a bodybuilder. We were meatheads. We were in the gym all the time. So
there's a reason that people think like that. And I think this applies to almost everything. And this is often one of the most difficult things to explain to new clients, because they're like, well, so-and-so does it this way and they look phenomenal. First off, most people, when they are looking at other people who are successful, tend to make the mistake of looking at the methods they use to get where they are without consideration for individual traits and circumstances that allowed them to be successful, sometimes in spite of methods that were very poor or inefficient. And an example that I like to use, I know a doctor locally who does not work out at all, but has almost unbelievable genetics. He's very muscular. If he were to walk into any gym and you looked at him, you would think he looked better than probably 99% of the people there. And he doesn't exercise at all and never has. He doesn't think he has to because he just looks like that, although there's a lot of other benefits. Now, most people don't have those genetics, but on a continuum, there are a bunch of people who have very good genetics and who will look good without any training at all. Now, if they go into the gym, anything that they do, whether it even produces a result or not, is going to be credited with the way they look. Imagine that this doctor went to a gym and he went and he stood in the corner and did something silly like hula hooped or just balanced on a BOSU ball or whatever ridiculous thing you could come up with. People would look at him and they'd see this phenomenal physique, not realizing he had no idea what he's doing. He's always looked that way. And they'd think, wow, well, this guy's in the corner with the hula hoop and he looks great. I'm going to start doing that too. Next week you come in, everybody's standing along the wall hula hooping instead of training properly. It's an extreme example, but this is exactly what people do. A lot of guys who are naturally very big, very muscular, because of that, will be attracted to strength training and bodybuilding. It is, people tend to gravitate towards things that they are good at, that they excel at. And a lot of people who don't have their genetics but want to look like that will look at them and say, well, that's what they're doing. Maybe that's what I should do, not realizing that those people have traits that allow them to look that way regardless of poor training and circumstances too. Sometimes, conservative estimates, most of the guys that you'll see in most gyms in the United States, probably about 10% or so are going to be taking some sort of growth drugs. And if you're looking at college athletics or higher, even high school sometimes, lots of it, a lot more than most people suspect. So that's also, you know, something to consider. Here's the thing though, regardless of what a particular person looks like, if they've made progress at all, it is because they're applying certain principles correctly. The principles are universal. It doesn't matter who you are. The principles apply exactly the same to every single person. But because there are differences in genetics, differences in how people's bodies respond, there are differences in people's circumstances, things like their sleep and work schedule and other activities that affect their body's ability to recover. And there's differences in diet, although that's within a person's control. The best application of exercise principles for any individual has to take all of these things into consideration. Now, if you look at somebody who has phenomenal genetics, who is capable of doing more exercise more often and still being able to recover and adapt without overtraining, the principles might be correct, but if you try to copy their application of the principles that's correct for their body and their circumstances, and your body and circumstances are different, then you are probably not going to get results that even begin to approach theirs. You might not even be capable of it, depending on your genetics. You might even overtrain. Another analogy I like to use is if you were to go into a clothing store and you see a poster with a model on it and they're wearing a particular outfit, you don't go to the sales clerk and say, I want that exact outfit that that person has, same size and everything. Most people know that. You know, obviously people vary in their sizes. It's a little bit easier for people to understand that because it's a visual thing. Some people are very tall, some are very short, most of us are in between. And you know if the model's really tall and you're really short that you have to get a different size. But with exercise, most people don't see that some people can tolerate more, recover faster, and are more responsive, and others are not. You need a different sized program to fit you. It's a mistake to copy these people. But who do we copy? When you want to be successful at something, you look at the people that appear to have been the most successful. And in bodybuilding and athletics, it's a lot of it is genetics. And a lot of people don't like that. They don't like it when you point out the fact that their fantasy of someday looking like Arnold is ridiculous. But it's important to understand this because those people, again, those are not the people that you should be modeling your exact approach after. Instead, you should look for average people who have been able to make progress and be successful in spite of not having the same genetics or in spite of maybe not having that pharmaceutical assistance. Look at people who applied the principles correctly.
I think you hit on a key point, and that is that it's not about you becoming like them. It's about you achieving the best version of you possible. And I think that that's what some people forget or miss when they're kind of creating these strategies. And we've spoken a lot about, you know, bodybuilding, because that's kind of what brought me into this. And that's, you know, kind of your background as well. But the average person who is not a bodybuilder doesn't want to aspire to be a bodybuilder, but wants to achieve peak physical condition in the least amount of time possible. That's who this type of training is for, right?
Yeah, and this is for everybody. There's literally no reason why any... Sorry, my watch is beeping here. There is no reason why any person who can voluntarily contract their muscles can't or shouldn't exercise. If you can contract your muscles at all, even if you are extremely feeble and bedridden, if you can contract, you can exercise. The application of the principles, how you go about it, might be very different than somebody else, but you can and should do it. Again, our health is largely dependent on the condition of our muscles. Your muscles do so many things that most people don't appreciate. They're involved in regulation of blood sugar levels and maintenance of body temperature, in circulation. A lot of people don't appreciate how much their muscles contribute to circulation of blood, the venous return. Your muscle, basically, when people start to lose muscle mass, they start to also lose bone mass. Sarcopenia, the gradual loss of muscle that occurs with aging, is the cause of most other problems associated with aging. If you maintain your muscle mass, you can prevent a lot of this. In fact, if you take somebody who has exercised properly, consistently, they can be in better shape in their 60s, 70s, and maybe past that than people in their 20s who don't do any exercise just because of the difference in muscle mass. The people talk about being over the hill. If we think about the hill as being a line graph that shows your, the best term is probably physiological headroom, your functional ability, your ability to do things is best thought of as how much can you do physically? What is the most you can do versus the least you can do? When you are an infant, the most you can do is pretty much lay there, which isn't much more than the least you can do. And then as you grow and develop, the most you can do increases consistently until it gets to some point where you're at your peak, and then you start to decline. And at the end, when the most you can do matches the least you can do, which is just lay there, you're close to being dead. Well, you can take that peak, what the most you can do is, and increase it by more than most people would imagine. So that when most people get their peak and it starts coming back down, yours, if yours is up here, when you're on the decline, you might end at a higher level than mm-hmm. they ever got to. But only if you increase your muscle, and through increasing your muscle, improve all those other supporting factors.
So let's, you know, one of the things that I think that is important is that anybody can do this, you know, and what you're saying is this is applicable to everybody. And you had a really great article on your website at baye.com, B-A-Y-E.com, and it had to do with getting kids involved in exercise and starting their strength training. What's an example Drew Baye workout that anybody can start participating in? Can you give us a couple of pointers?
Well, first off, there is no single workout that is best for anybody. Any workout, any recommendation that I would give would at best be a starting point from which to make adjustments based on how your body responds. But a good template to start from is you need to include exercises for all the major muscle groups. The easiest way to do this is with multi-joint exercises that involve pushing and pulling in different planes, like a chest press movement, and that can be on a machine or doing a bench press, an overhead pressing movement, a standing press or a shoulder press machine, a compound rowing movement, and that can be a bent over barbell row or a seated cable row or machine row, a pull down movement like a chin up, a pull up, or a pull down machine, and then compound movements for the hip and thigh muscles, a squatting movement like a squat or a leg press, a trunk extension movement like a hip and back machine, back extension machine, stiff-legged deadlift, or, and again, it depends on the individual. Sometimes a person might not be able to do these exercises due to certain physical limitations. You can break these apart into their component exercises. If you have a multi-joint movement, identify the different joint movements involved and perform simple or like rotary form exercises for those. Those six general categories of movement will cover almost all the major muscle groups. And then to that, I would add direct exercise for the abs, the calves, the neck, including flexion and extension, and the forearms. And a person doesn't have to do all of these in the same workout. They can spread them out over a few workouts, depending on how much they can do, what they can recover from. But minimally, as a starting point, you want to include movements for all those muscle groups, those six compound exercises. Again, horizontal push, horizontal pull, vertical push and pull, and a squatting type movement, and a trunk extension or hip hinging type movement, and then simple exercise. A lot of people call them isolation or single joint. That's not accurate. Simple versus compound is a better way to categorize them. Simple movements for the smaller muscle groups, again, like the abs, calves, and neck, that aren't really effectively worked by those bigger ones. I don't like to make too general a recommendation with the exercises, though, because it depends, again, on the individual. It depends on the equipment available to them. Some people might find that they can do like a dozen exercises very hard in a workout, and they easily recover to and adapt from that. For some people, I mean, you still have to do exercises for all the muscle groups, but you might have to divide them up over multiple workouts so they're not doing all of it at once. But as a starting point, minimally, your workouts need to include exercises for all those muscle groups. That is the most efficient way in terms of the most muscle for the fewest exercises that you can do that.
Now, you've written several books on the topic of exercise, and for folks that maybe don't have access to weights, or they travel too much, or they just simply don't want to be in a sweaty, smelly gym, you have other types of resistance training programs, don't you?
Yeah, I wrote a book called Project Kratos, which is on the application of high-intensity training principles to body weight exercise. And part of the reason for writing that was because I had clients who traveled frequently, and I wanted to give them something that they would be able to do while they were traveling without worrying about the limitations of a hotel gym. Or I had some clients who had manufacturing in China, and they would be in places for a while where they didn't have access to any equipment. Most of the existing body weight training programs were awful, so I had to come up with something myself, better application of these principles, so that they could do this stuff without worrying about, you know, do I have weights, do I have a gym. I also wrote a book on isometric training that explains how you can do an exercise or how you can do a workout using nothing but a strap, exercising all the different muscle groups isometrically. So it kind of frees you from the gym, gives you some options if you're traveling or if you just don't like to work out in a gym.
Yeah, well, that's great. You know, and it's been so much fun having you on the show. I'd love to have you back at another point. And then I know we're also going to have you on the Atlasphere and some other projects coming up. So if folks want to find out more, maybe buy and invest in your books or your personal training, because I know you do coaching and stuff for individuals, where can they find Drew Bay?
They can find me at bay.com, and this B-A-Y-E.com. And if they look for me on most other social media, if they just search for Drew Bay, I'm on Twitter, YouTube, Gab, Facebook, and a couple of the others. But if they just go to bay.com, B-A-Y-E.com, they'll be able to find most of the rest through there.
Well, thank you again for being a part of the show. And for those of you driving around without a pencil, never fear. UnlockYourWealthToday.com is here where you can visit Drew's show page, get the links to all of his resources, and so much more. For the maestro of moolah, Michael Terry, I'm Heather Wagenhals. Now go out and unlock your wealth today.
UnlockYourWealthToday.com is produced by Heather Wagenhals and the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation. UnlockYourWealthToday.com and its affiliates are copyrighted 2018 with all rights reserved. For more information on the Keys to Riches Financial Wellness Series, please visit our website at www.unlockyourwealthtoday.com.